You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Ever since George Bush came into office, he has taken a hard line towards negotiations with North Korea over their nuclear weapons program. The heat has been turned up since North Korea announced it was abandoning its arrangement with the U.S. and U.N. a few weeks ago. South Koreans are increasingly fearful that the United States seems determined to push their northern neighbors to the brink of war. Chalmers Johnson, president of the Japan Policy Research Institute and author of Blowback, spoke with KPFK Los Angeles about how South Koreans feel held hostage to America's belligerency. Host Ian Masters asked Chalmers Johnson his opinion about Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld's confident assertion that the United States would have no problem fighting two wars at once.
I think Rumsfeld's statement was unbelievably irresponsible, but then that's nothing new for him. The North Koreans in their broadcast today referred to him as a blabbermouth who just shoots from the lip. In the first place, it isn't true. We probably couldn't fight two wars simultaneously. The military has already come out and said that wasn't so. But much more important than that, any threat of the use of force on the Korean Peninsula by the United States means that we've lost South Korea as an ally, that it will be gone. They will have nothing to do with this again in the future, and they will throw us out. Once you start doing that, it'll probably unravel much of the American military position in East Asia. The attitudes in South Korea today are really powerfully in favor of the argument that this is caused by Bush. It's caused by his extreme belligerence and lack of understanding of the meaning of diplomacy, of his almost total ignorance of the area. You'll recall that when he went up to the DMZ and was looking through binoculars toward the north, that he still had the caps on the binoculars, so he wasn't actually seeing anything. But the attitudes that you get from people on the streets of Seoul right now are, if you get threatened by a nation with nuclear weapons like the United States, then the obvious thing to do is to get some of your own. There seems to be real sympathy for the views in the North. Moreover, that they don't like this idea of axis of evil when the Koreans in the North are simply no different from the Koreans in the South. They're all part of the same affair. This also is deeply confusing to the Japanese. I think the main thing we wait to see right now are the attitudes of the Chinese and the Russians, both of whom seem to be extremely cool to the American position. I think the great problem we face at the present is the only idea that Powell and company seems to be able to come up with is some kind of economic blockade of North Korea. That strikes me as precisely what the South Koreans do not want, that the new president, Noh Moo-hyun, just elected on a plank of maintaining economic contact with the poverty-stricken North. And therefore, I would think the biggest problem the administration is going to have will be to get South Korea, Russia, and China to maintain such a blockade. But indeed, it's a dangerous crisis. It need not have occurred that the so-called joint agreement of 1994 was working. The United States has just as bad a record of living up to the terms of that agreement as anyone in North Korea does, in that the agreement also called for trade and recognition, which we never did. The Carter administration, or Clinton administration, sat around for almost 5 years simply expecting North Korea to collapse and hoping that it would before it began to talk about delivering the less ominous power reactors that were agreed to. North Korea has no sources of power. It has to import everything, and it's been economically not viable ever since its two main supporters during the Cold War, China and Russia. The Cold War ended. They both now have extremely friendly and strong trading and diplomatic and every other kind of relations with South Korea. But I think what's really happened this time, and being seen in the rest of East Asia but not reported in our press, is that the United States is looking isolated. It's looking, once again, like a belligerent bully who can't think of any other way to solve any problem except the carrier task force and the cruise missile. And they haven't noticed that's just getting to be irrelevant in East Asia, that South Koreans are much, much more confident of their own economic abilities, abilities to govern their society, and are tired of having 37,000 American troops based there with still, I mean, you know, after all, the headquarters of the Eighth Army are still right in downtown Seoul in the old buildings that the Japanese created back in 1894 when they set up their military headquarters in South Korea. It is culturally so obtuse, no one in his right mind would listen to the Americans talking about Korea. They've been there for 50 years, but apparently have learned absolutely nothing. This problem could be solved fairly fast if the Americans would just simply back down and start negotiating with North Korea, as everybody in the area wants them to do. I guess I would say it would be time for the country that is forever snapping its suspenders as the world's great superpower start showing some signs of generosity. North Korea is a loser. It lost in the Cold War. It's a failed communist state that has been playing an extremely weak hand, quite brilliantly, to try and keep alive, viable, to not be forced into a sort of humiliating merger with South Korea without any way to negotiate its own terms. Meanwhile, the United States continues to threaten it daily, and that there is no doubt that they took deadly seriously Bush's popping off about the axis of evil, which never made any sense to anybody, but our limp-wristed press naturally wouldn't think of criticizing a thing like this. It was an outrageous remark to have put in the State of the Union address, and it's meaningless, but it is certainly going to come back to haunt us. What you see in the South Korean press today is a very strong sense that they fear the United States a great deal more than they do North Korea. They're afraid that the United States is being backed into a corner, that Bush doesn't know what he's doing, that he's got an extremely belligerent and unilateralist bunch of Likudniks running foreign policy from the Pentagon, that they're trigger-happy.
But by Likudniks, you mean that's the Israeli right?
Yeah, I mean the Israeli right, people who are ready to expand wars rather radically, and who seem totally uninterested in peace or peacemaking or peace agreements. The American record of unilateralism has now gone on so far that the South Koreans are afraid that the Americans do not know how to back down, do not know how to acknowledge they have dug themselves into a hole, that they're so full of cant words like credibility and things like that, that they might just unleash a war, which would have savage consequences. I mean, Seoul is an extremely rich, handsome city of 12 million people, less than 50 miles from the DMZ. If you start to use, if there's any kind of a war on the Korean Peninsula, the huge forces of North Korea, based just north of the DMZ, will rain rockets and artillery shells that will kill millions. The South Koreans know this. They know they are hostage to this, and they feel they've been made hostage by America's belligerency and its obtuseness.
Well, I do recall during the Vietnam War that that agony was prolonged by Nixon and Kissinger.
Yes.
Purely on the basis that we can't cut and run.
All this talk about how enormously popular George Bush is and what a wizard Karl Rove was and how they've got the Americans in their hands and all the rest of it.
Well, that's all true, by the way.
But it is true. Moreover, American foreign policy is based almost entirely on, just when you mentioned the Vietnam War, it reminded me, on domestic political considerations. That without doubt, I am certain that it's Rove that caused Bush to go to the UN over Iraq in the face of Rumsfeld's desire to just go ahead and do it on her own.
And when he figured out in polls
that the American public didn't like a Middle Eastern war without any allies at all.
Right, he also engineered the coup against Lott, or at least
he
opening there.
And that's what worries them, is that the United States is isolated, inward-looking, worked itself into a trap, and also has almost no cultural understanding of how extremely unlikely it is that the North Koreans will back down in the face of this kind of belligerence.
Chalmers Johnson, president of the Japan Policy Research Institute and author of the book Blowback, speaking with KPFK host Ian Masters. In an op-ed piece in the New York Times last week, Congressman Charles Rangel of New York proposed the reinstatement of the military draft. Public opinion is as varied as our nation. As discussion of this issue grows, so does the gap between those supporting the draft and their opposition. Here are some of the opinions expressed this morning on C-SPAN.
Yes, I think that the draft should be reinstated because, first of all, we are all Americans, whether we're white, black, whatever color, whatever our financial status. You know, none of that should matter. We are all Americans, and we should all step up to the plate and defend our country against these people, you know, who are determined to bring us down. I think there was a lady who said she didn't approve of all this because she felt it was President Bush's personal vendetta. This lady needs to get a clue. President Bush's so-called personal vendetta is designed to protect all of us, not just his father, but our fathers, our brothers, sisters, everybody who's American. And if September 11th taught us anything, it should teach these people that, yes, these people can come over here and destroy our people and our country, and they will if given an opportunity to do so. And I personally thank God that we have a leader like President Bush who is willing to show these people that they cannot come and destroy us and our way of life. Whether you're there by choice or whether you're there by draft, if you're out there and you know that this enemy is coming to try to kill you, you're going to do your best, whether you're there by choice or not, to defend yourself and your country.
I have a son who was in the Gulf War. He's still suffering from diseases that he got over there, rash, low-grade fever, and anybody who goes over in that area is subject to this. And on the front page of the St. Pete Times today is the reason why Bush is pushing this war. He wants to take over the oil.
One mother in South Carolina who supports the draft, one mother from St. Petersburg, Florida, who opposes it. Thanks to C-SPAN for those voices. On Friday, Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington, D.C. held a roundtable for peace. Local activist Ruby Sales, distinguished for her years of support for minority rights, accused the Bush administration of nurturing a culture of violence. Sales asserts that the violence against nations like Iraq are a reflection of the violence that is an integral part of our domestic culture.
Wow, Sarah, you said a lot, and what you've just said really underscores, I think, a very critical issue here. Whether we're talking about Iraq, whether we're talking about Palestine, whether we're talking about Afghanistan, we're really talking about a culture of violence. We're talking about the fact that America is the chief exporter and breeder of violence at home and around the world. Whether you're talking about dropping bombs at the border of Pakistan, dropping bombs on Afghanistan, or whether you're talking about at home throwing young black men on the pavement, the police with their feet against their necks, or whether you're talking about rounding up Middle Eastern or Arab men, we're talking about a problem that Dr. King identified. He talked about the sore, the cancer that's at the heart of the American soul. And that's a culture of violence. So we are dealing with this culture of violence when we look at issues like the war in Iraq. And it is a culture of violence that has bled in Latin America, in Central America, in Mississippi, in Afghanistan, in Vietnam, has bled oppression and injustice around the world. So as we look at this issue, we must bring a broader contextualization to the question, or we will find ourselves as peace activists running from one trouble spot to the next without putting the pressure. It's like if you've got a wound on your body and you're bleeding and the wound is in your stomach, you don't put pressure on your toes. You go directly to your stomach and apply pressure to stop the bleeding. And so that as peace activists in this country, we must apply pressure in America. If we stop and turn around this culture of violence here and use our power and resources to apply pressure to the woundedness in this society, then there would not be an Iraq. There would not be an Afghanistan. There would not be the policies that this government supports Israel in terms of Palestine. So we have got to be very clear that a great part of our work is right here at home, addressing the triple evils of racism, militarism, and materialism in this country. 2% of men own more than 88% of the world's wealth. 12 Western countries use more than 88% of the world's water supply. So these are critical issues. That's violence when you deny people the right to have food, water, and shelter. Martin Luther King reminded us in his Vietnam speech that that's structural violence, systemic violence against people, so that there is a connection between the violence abroad and the systemic violence that this government, the war that this government has unleashed on the poor, women, lesbian, gays, progressive communities. And so we must begin to address these issues and do some work at home, focusing on the evils of our government and really making the hard choice that we're going to be on the front line of calling the questions on our government right here. And the other thing that I want to say very quickly, as we've made a list of countries this morning, it really strikes me that all of the countries where this violence is, where the government is bleeding this violence, are countries of color. We've got to be very clear and understand that there's an ideological, that this government is promoting an ideological war designed to contain and destroy community of colors around the world in order to have the resources and to have world domination. It is a war against people of color because the world is no longer predominantly white. The world is two-thirds color. This country, as quiet as it is kept, is no longer a white majority. It is a colored majority. And so the question that's at the center of all of this war on people of color, whether you call it a war on terrorism, is the fundamental ideological question of how to maintain white supremacy in a two-thirds colored world. And that we have to make the connection between the warehousing of African-American and Latino men in prisons and the detention of men of color, Muslim men and Middle Eastern men around the world. What's up with that? Why the attack on men of color? What are the connections we see? So we've got to begin to draw these connections in the peace movement and do the hard anti-racist, anti-classist work that we need to do in this society so that the elephant begins to feel the pressure and is brought to its knees.
Political activist Ruby Sales speaking at Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington. Peace Watch spoke with Rick Janhow of Project YANO, Youth and Non-Military Opportunities, an 18-year-old California group that works as counter-military recruiters. We asked Janhow if he thinks Rangel's bill stands a chance of passing in the upcoming Congress.
Well, there's some support in Congress for returning to the draft, I'm sure. We see bills introduced periodically and hear calls for return of conscription every so often, so I'm sure there is some support already. I guess the question is how much support, and also the question is whether the Bush administration and the Pentagon would support that. From everything that we've heard, it seems as though this particular proposal will not really go too far, that the Bush administration and Pentagon in particular are not ready at this time to advocate for a draft.
And that's surprising.
Well, it's not when you look at the, sort of the big picture here. The Pentagon has its own agenda, and one of the top priorities it has is to cultivate a closer relationship with civilian society. And the Pentagon knows that the last time we had a draft, that draft was actually a stimulus for people to call into question the legitimacy of the military establishment. And I think that since the end of the last draft, they have figured it out that they can be much more effective influencing society if they find other ways to reach out to young people. And what they have been emphasizing for the last decade and a half is basically getting into institutions of socialization and using those institutions to try to reach out and influence the values that young people develop. So they're going into schools. They're trying to put in junior ROTC programs. They're introducing military aptitude testing. They're introducing programs at the middle school and elementary school levels. And this is gaining them a benefit that they would not have if young people were told, basically with a gun to their head, they have to go into the military.
Mm. So you say they have programs that as early as elementary school level?
Yes. There are military units all across the country that establish official partnerships with elementary schools and middle schools. And they use these partnerships to send personnel into schools, to visit classrooms, to take children out to military bases and ships, and to do a lot of propagandizing that kind of happens without most people being even aware of it.
Mm. And so we know that the No Child Left Behind Act was recently passed in the Congress. Refresh our memories about that. I know that it gives military recruiters access to the children.
Well, it gives them the right to have access to high schools and students in those schools, and also the names, addresses, and phone numbers of high school students, even if it what formerly was the policy of the individual school or school district to not release that kind of information or to restrict such access.
And is that unprecedented?
It's not really. In fact, that's one of the little facets of this whole thing that has escaped a lot of attention. When recruiters went to Congress a couple of years ago to complain about what they saw as barriers to recruiting, they cited huge figures like half of all schools refusing to give them access, or even in some cases a larger percentage than that. And we, those of us who actually are focusing on that issue full-time and have been going into schools and working to counter recruiters, knew that that really was a misrepresentation of reality, that in fact schools by and large were granting unrestricted access. There were some notable exceptions. But what happened is that the recruiters realized that the best strategy for them was to misrepresent the situation, and they were then able to stampede Congress into passing this recruiter access law as part of the No Child Left Behind Act. That made sure then that if there were any schools that were throwing up barriers, they would have a tool to try to bring down the barrier.
So what are the percentage of young people that are actually volunteering to join the military, let's say this year, for example, or not this year, it's a brand new year, but in recent years?
Well, I'm not sure what the percentage is, but the military, all the armed forces combined, have to recruit a couple hundred thousand people every year to deal with the turnover. So that's the type of quota that they have. And what we point out is that it's not just filling slots for positions in the military that the military goes into schools and is trying to reach young people. They're also trying to influence the way they think. I mean, why else would they go into elementary schools? You can't sign up a six-year-old. It just, you know, it's not possible.
Mm-hmm.
They're there to try to influence the way people are going to think, their values, and actually it's an attempt to try to influence the future political climate in this country. So in some ways the greater danger is that, because they are trying to affect so many more students than just the ones that they need to fill their enlistment quotas. It's another reason why we're concerned about Congressman Rangel's proposal. There are several problems with it. One of them is that his proposal rests on this assumption that if there are more affluent kids in the military, then their parents are going to be more cautious about supporting any war, parents that are politicians or just the general public. And what's wrong with that is that, A, there's never been any evidence historically or otherwise that having a draft does in fact get more affluent kids into combat ranks. The facts just don't support that, and there's no real support for the idea that it would now, because kids who are affluent and they would be primarily white kids are going to have greater resources to take advantage of draft deferments, even though there are fewer deferments right now in the law. And for those more affluent kids who can't totally avoid the military, when they're in the military, they're going to be assigned jobs and roles that are going to be less risky. So the trend of having conscripts who are in combat roles, disproportionately low-income and people of color is going to continue. The other assumption is that that somehow by having young people in this risky position, that is going to put the brakes on any tendency to go to war. And again, historically, there is no evidence whatsoever that that's true. We had a draft prior to Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
and we used the draft. The draft made it possible to wage that war in Southeast Asia for 10 solid years. So if that is Congressman Rangel's strategy for trying to stop a war in Iraq, then I really feel sorry and fear for the welfare of the people of Iraq.
Well, I think that in all fairness to the congressman, and I'm not trying to in any way defend his position, but just for the sake of clarity, I think he is saying that, I guess, given that historical precedent with or that historical fact with Vietnam, that perhaps the American public would now be so sensitized to that just raising the issue that American soldiers could be coming home in body bags might make them less inclined to want to rush into Iraq. I was concerned that, you know, this whole thing could backfire. You say that there's no chance that there's enough support in Congress anyway to pass this.
Right. At this point, there isn't. I think, though, that actually, here's the problem. Even if there isn't a likelihood that it would move through Congress, what Congressman Rangel's proposal does and his statements that he's making, it helps legitimize the idea of having a draft. And it feeds a lot of the mythology about the draft being a democratic way of sharing the burden that other liberals are citing very frequently. There are people who would like to see as many young people as possible sent through the military system. And some of them are liberals, some of them are militarists. And what Congressman Rangel is doing with this proposal is that he is feeding that movement. And he's also perpetuating some of these myths. So it may not, in fact, result in a draft now, but a few years from now, if the Pentagon decides that they have more to gain by having compulsory military service than they do right now, they may shift and decide that they want to support it. And this sort of lays the foundation for that, and that's what really concerns me.
Okay. Rick Jankow of Project YANO, Youth and Non-Military Opportunities. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. by Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. We had production assistance from Adil Hamad of KPFA, Ron Pinchback of WPFW, David Russo, and Eddie Becker. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Copies of this program can be ordered from the Pacifica Radio Archives by visiting the website at pacificaarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send us your feedback to peacewatch@pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thank you for listening.